Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Dr. Meredith Gansner. She works at Boston Children's Hospital and is also instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Gansner is also the author of the new book, Teen Depression Gone Viral, Why Kids Are More Vulnerable Than Ever, and How You Can Protect Your Child's Health and Happiness. Welcome to the Exchange, Dr. Gansner.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I often ask authors why they wrote their book, but you actually wrote the answer in your book. Would you mind reading that passage from your introduction?
Absolutely. I wrote, "This book will help you understand your teenager's online experiences by weaving relevant information about adolescent digital media use into each chapter. This way, you'll be better able to recognize the myriad ways your teen's digital media habits can influence or be influenced by their illness. This approach also affords me the luxury of going into greater detail about managing problematic online behaviors and promoting healthier digital media use, as opposed to stuffing all my screen-related guidance into one bloated chapter. Full disclosure, the foremost expert on your teen's depression is probably your teen, but you and I both know that teenagers aren't always great at talking about their feelings, especially to their parents. They do sometimes talk to me, a child and adolescent psychiatrist who has seen depression present itself in a wide variety of settings, outpatient clinics, emergency rooms, medical floors, and inpatient psychiatric units, to name a few. I've also spent the last decade researching digital media use specifically in adolescents with psychiatric disorders like depression. The combination of my research and clinical experience has given me perspective on the management of adolescent depression in our screen-dependent society. I am also quite the avid Googler, but this is apparently not an actual credential. Many parents have asked me about what they read online and about the potential adverse effects of continuous digital media use. However, there is only so much information that can reasonably be covered during an emergency room assessment or 30-minute outpatient visit. Parents understandably prioritize questions like, what exactly is an antidepressant, over questions like, should I purchase a parental control app? Ideally, this book will answer some of the digital media related questions that you haven't yet been able to ask. While many of the questions have answers that aren't one size fits all, my responses should at least help you identify solutions that could work for your family. Ultimately, I wrote this book out of admiration for the parents and families who had to learn for themselves how digital media influenced adolescent depression. These families shouldn't have been burdened with navigating dangerous online challenges or cyberbullying all on their own, yet burdened they were. I hope this book can save future families from having to learn through trial by fire."
Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
The way you formatted the book makes it pretty easy to read and digest. It's also useful as a handy resource that I think guides me to what I need to know, depending on the questions I have. What were your thoughts when creating the format of the book for readers?
Pretty much exactly that. I know now more than ever, because of the way most of us get our information, we are both parents and children are kind of inundated with online information from so many different resources. And it can be really hard to sift through all of that information, to make sense of it, to figure out what to trust and what not to trust. And so I wanted to be mindful of creating a book that wasn't just reinventing the wheel, right? Just wasn't going through all of the information about adolescent depression that you could potentially get online. I wanted to make a resource that would supplement a lot of the online sources and research that is oftentimes done by my patients and their families. So that was really the hope in creating this book in a way that can be easily navigated and can answer specific questions in specific spots where you can, if you have an interest in antidepressants particularly or therapy, you can go right to that section and learn more about that rather than necessarily having to read through the entire book. Although I'd love it for people to read through the entire book, of course.
Well, it does feel like a resource guide. You describe depression in two ways, what's happening inside the body and what we see externally as indicators and behaviors. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So unfortunately, depression inside the body is still a bit of a black box in that it's a mystery. We have a fair amount of information about certain chemicals like neurotransmitters, which people may have heard of as chemicals like dopamine or norepinephrine, and how they might be related to depression. And in particular, serotonin is oftentimes the neurotransmitter most associated with depression. And so for many years, clinicians and psychologists and mental health workers had hypothesized that, you know, serotonin was really the big chemical that was sort of awry inside the body, and that was what was causing depression. But more and more studies have shown that it doesn't seem to just be serotonin. It seems more complicated than that. There are other neurotransmitters involved in depression, and we know there are probably sort of multiple types of depression, and we know that there are sort of markers of inflammation in the body. So we do know it is, you know, a real medical illness, but we're still trying to figure figure out what exactly is going wrong in the body. And so I think it's really important for families and teenagers to be aware that there's still a lot we have left to learn about what's going on inside the body.
Okay. And as parents, we're seeing outward indicators. Talk about those.
Yeah. So one of the biggest indicators of depression in teenagers specifically, and this differs from in adults, is irritability. And that is super tricky in teenagers because, of course, teenagers are known to be irritable at baseline. They're not known for being the most agreeable of populations. So that can be a symptom that is often missed, as parents may chalk it up to kind of normal adolescence and sort of this normal developmental stage. But there are also other signs to look out for in addition to the irritability. There's, this decrease in energy where kids might just feel like they don't have energy to do anything or get out of bed. You may see teenagers that have too much sleep or too little sleep, waking up early in the morning hours. Teens might not eat as much as they normally do, or sometimes they can eat too much. They may feel restless or alternatively feel like they just, again, with a low energy, not want to move at all. And they also might have thoughts of being worthless or hopeless, or that, they aren't enjoying things that they used to enjoy as much as they used to. And, perhaps most significantly, some teens will have symptoms and thoughts of suicidal ideation. So thinking it might be better off if I wasn't alive, or even thoughts of wanting to end their lives by suicide.
Well, you ask a good question early in your book. How can you be sure that your teen is depressed? And I thought that's a really good question, because a teen could be having a bad day.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. When I had kind of formulated that question in my head, I was talking to my husband, who's also a psychiatrist, and he was saying, it's depression. I mean, of course, when you see depression. I mean, you know when you see it, right? And I found myself reflecting on a lot of patients, and I really only see children and adolescents these days, and that for me, it isn't always obvious, even as a psychiatrist. Sometimes I have patients who are wedded to certain psychiatric symptoms, and so may say, like, I'm depressed. I definitely have depression, when upon digging, it actually seems like anxiety is the primary symptom. Or sometimes they might have an underlying personality disorder, like borderline personality disorder, which can have symptoms of self-injurious behavior, feelings of low self-worth, which, of course, as I mentioned before, accompany depression. So it isn't always obvious. And then teenagers, on top of that, they may be irritable because they are normal teenagers, and they may be spending more time in their rooms now that digital devices are how most teenagers interact with each other and get information about news in the outside world. And so it's almost more normal for teens to be in places where parents wouldn't necessarily notice that they're less engaged or not socializing with peers. So I think it can almost be harder now to tell if a teenager is depressed than previously.
My guest is Dr. Meredith Gansner. She's the author of Teen Depression Gone Viral, Why Kids Are More Vulnerable Than Ever, and How You Can Protect Your Child's Health and Happiness. So, Doc, you talk about depression screening questionnaires. I'd never heard of those.
Yeah, so you don't always have to use a depression screening questionnaire. I just want to throw that out there. But many, especially primary care practices, will use these screeners to try to get a kind of initial sense of whether or not depression is either likely or less likely. And so the most common thing that we see in primary care clinics is either the PHQ-2 or PHQ-9, which is called the patient health questionnaire. And 2 refers to 2 questions, and 9 refers to 9 questions. And these brief questionnaires will offer sort of an array of symptoms, like I mentioned before, and ask, on a scale of 0 to 2, how often are you having these symptoms, from, never to every day? And then teens will answer that accordingly. And then the provider can get a sense of whether or not depression is more likely than not, and especially with certain symptoms, whether major depression is more likely than not. But depression can certainly be diagnosed without using a formal screener. And I think what's even trickier, as I mentioned in the book, is that some teenagers definitely appear to be depressed, but yet when you have them fill out a screen, they come out as, no sign of depression, couldn't be better. When in actuality, that's something that, both maybe family and the clinician are quite concerned about.
Well, no one wants to hear that they have a disorder. So what are some of the ways that teens typically react when they hear that there's a diagnosis of depression?
It's interesting because I think maybe taking in kind of a bimodal approach, where now maybe before we had, excuse me, allergy season, before we had teens, you know, certainly not wanting to have a psychiatric disorder and you know, stigma against mental illness absolutely still exists. And so I do still have many patients who will say, I'm not depressed, when it really appears to both, you know, other people in their lives and myself that depression is very likely. But conversely, I also have patients that are sort of interested in having a psychiatric disorder or identify as having a psychiatric disorder that isn't depression, but it's just a different diagnosis. And so when they're told that they have depression, it isn't that they don't want to have a diagnosis, it's that they don't want to have depression. And so I think those two populations of youth are very important to separate and understand kind of in different lights. But that being said, both populations, you can't just kind of march in, and I've tried, believe me, in it, it's not gone well, and say, look, no, look, these are the symptoms of depression, and you have all of these, so therefore you have depression, right? That never goes well. And certainly if I say, no, you know, you don't have autism or you don't have ADHD, if they think that those diagnoses are, you know, more likely for them than depression. So you try to find something that the patient will agree upon and kind of start there in terms of treatments, you know, something in their lives that may be a symptom of depression, that perhaps doesn't feel quite as scary for individuals who don't want to, you know, admit having a disorder at all. So things like sleep are a good place to start, and addressing how to improve sleep, which improved sleep is also a really great way to help with depression symptoms. And then for youth who may think that they have a different psychiatric disorder, it's trying to find the parts of that psychiatric disorder that maybe they don't have, like autism or ADHD, that they really identify with, but that also may be shared in some way with depression. So for ADHD, for example, which a lot of youth are identifying as having, poor concentration is a feature of both illnesses. And that can be a good place to start in thinking, okay, like rather than getting into it, you have this diagnosis or you don't have this diagnosis, how can we really address the concentration issues that you're having and struggling with?
Well, we have a couple of minutes before we have to take a break, but how does screen time become a factor? What are the pros and cons?
Yeah, a couple of minutes of the massive question with so many different answers. Well, it's tricky. You know, I never want to go out there and say screen time is all bad, because frankly, the evidence doesn't support the fact that screen time overall is a causal factor of depression. What is problematic is that many things that can come about from prolonged screen time are known to be depression risk factors. So thinking about things like poor sleep, right? If you're on screens at night, that can interfere with your sleep. We know that limited exercise, that's something that it's much harder to get exercise if you're spending all your time indoors on your screens. So that's something that can contribute to depression symptoms. Lack of UV light exposure, that's something that is also known potentially to cause depression symptoms. And that's something that, again, if you're indoors all day on your phone, you may not be getting much UV light exposure. And then just the myriad of things that you can see online that could also be significant stressors and potentially cause depression through, you know, being bullied online, or significant conflict with maybe a romantic interest online, or even encountering really horrific or traumatizing content online, which could be enough of a stressor to kind of contribute to a depressive episode. So there are certainly many, many factors that are a result of prolonged screen use that can then contribute to a depressive episode. But that being said, the reality is we're all on screens a lot of the time now. And so we have to figure out, as clinicians and as a society, how to incorporate screens into our care for our patients. And so there are ways that we can form communities online, so teens don't necessarily feel as ostracized or alone in their depression. We have evidence that, you know, many teens, especially those that have mental health issues, they turn to the internet now to learn about their illness. And if they're accessing the right kind of sources, right, accredited sources that are, you know, meant to provide accurate and measured information about the illness and its treatment, then that actually can be incredibly helpful for teens and parents too, to use screens in a way that can benefit them in learning about their illness and treating it. And there are now even apps that are made, you know, for the purpose of providing therapies, because we know that therapy, it's hard to come by. There aren't enough therapists for how many teens right now are struggling. And so while we're still trying to get a handle on, you know, which apps might be, you know, safest and most effective for as a treatment for depression, there is certainly evidence that they may be helpful in kind of augmenting depression treatment. So time will tell whether or not they could be a standalone treatment for depression one day. So there are certainly pros and cons on both sides.
Okay, so the internet can be a tool that we can use for good.
Sure.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Dr. Meredith Gansner. She's the author of the new book, Teen Depression Gone Viral, Why Kids Are More Vulnerable Than Ever, and How You Can Protect Your Child's Health and Happiness. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Dr. Meredith Gansner. She's a physician at Boston Children's Hospital and instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Gansner is also the author of the new book, Teen Depression Gone Viral, Why Kids Are More Vulnerable Than Ever, and How You Can Protect Your Child's Health and Happiness. Now, before the break, we were talking about screen time and some of the factors that can lead to teen depression. And, Doc, here in Southern Oregon, we live in a scenic valley, surrounded by picturesque mountains with rivers, lakes, and streams throughout. But within our idyllic setting, we're dealing with a serious problem of teen suicide. A couple of local leaders here are trying to raise awareness to this issue. They're Bob and Deanne. Bob Weiss is vice president and general manager of the local TV station KOBI-TV NBC5, and Deanne Everson is CEO and executive director of the United Way of Jackson County. They collaborated on a messaging campaign called Tomorrow Needs You. I'd like to play an excerpt from my recent interview with them and then get your reaction on the other side, if that's okay. Let's start with a better understanding, Deanne. What's the problem that this initiative is addressing?
Well, our community, not unlike every community, suffers from relatively high suicide completion rate. And our efforts to come together are to say we can do better. And how we can do better is to actually talk to one another, be open, alleviate the stigma of suicide as much as we can, and tell people there's a better way. And in fact, that tomorrow needs all of us, and especially tomorrow needs you.
How did this collaborative come about, Bob?
We started a program called In This Together in 2019 that ran for 5 years. And it basically started from Deanne and I having a conversation about the amount of teen suicides happening in Southern Oregon. How can we address this? We have come to find out it's good to talk about it. It's good to, as Deanne said, break the stigma of having these conversations. And they're not easy conversations to have. But the importance of everyone knowing that there is somebody that will listen to them is a huge message. And it's our part to get that out to as many people as possible.
It breaks my heart that we have so much teen suicide. Any idea what's causing that?
I think that's the most common question we get asked. And the answer is everything. Suicide is often a moment of desperation. It's not necessarily that one has a mental health diagnosis or a mental illness. It's often that there's a desperate moment, and it can be from loss of a friend, a relationship, a health diagnosis, loss of financial resources, a parent losing a job, a person losing their job. And it's all those things. It's life. And life can be really hard, and we can still make it.
So, Doc, what are your thoughts?
It's incredible when a community gets together and tries to tackle teen depression and suicide. It is a heartbreaking thing that in many countries, rates of teen suicide are rising. And it's true. We don't really know why, because everything could potentially be a factor. And there have been so many different factors that have been proposed. And, you know, almost all of them are fairly credible in terms of ways that, you know, could either worsen depression symptoms or cause significant trauma and stress. But I think what I really liked hearing about their initiative, you know, the two things that I think are most important are that, you know, communication is absolutely vital in terms of people feeling as though they're not alone and people feeling like they can connect to others, especially teenagers. You know, adolescents are inherently kind of drawn to their peer groups at this age. And so they, you know, sort of never want to really feel alone per se, or maybe they don't want to just be with their parents. They want to be, you know, with others like them. And so being able to have have access to people that are going through the same thing that they're going through is so important to destigmatize the illness and to make them feel as though there are people there supporting them and then they're not alone. But what's also critical is that while communicating about suicide is critical, you need to be able to communicate about suicide in a way that also is healthy. We know that the way that media talks about suicide can actually produce either increased suicidal behavior in certain vulnerable individuals or decreased suicidal behavior. And it really depends upon how one talks about suicide. And so in the clip, you know, they mentioned that there is a better way. And that is fantastic because we know that through kind of what's called the Papageno effect and referring to Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute, if you offer individuals who are thinking about suicide alternative options and an out and give them, you know, better ways that they might be able to cope with what they're going through and make those visible and, you know, readily accessible, that is a tremendous support for individuals who might be considering suicide. And I think as long as we continue to, with our initiatives to try to tackle teen suicide, keep stressing the importance of that there are other ways and here's how you can access them. I think that we could make a significant progress. And I do think that especially in the digital world, we could be doing a lot more to try to get those initiatives out there in ways that teens can be more exposed to them, especially to counteract a lot of the unfortunately, potentially suicide, promoting material that is very easily accessible to vulnerable youth online.
My guest is Dr. Meredith Gansner. She's the author of Teen Depression Gone Viral, Why Kids Are More Vulnerable Than Ever, and How You Can Protect Your Child's Health and Happiness. So, Doc, in your book, you write about NSSI. What is that?
Mm-hmm. So NSSI refers to non-suicidal self-injury. Sometimes it can also be referred to as self-injurious behavior. So those are behaviors in which an individual will intentionally harm themselves, oftentimes by cutting, although it can be through other ways, like hurting one's hand by slamming it to the wall or burning oneself. But cutting is probably one of the more common manifestations of NSSI. And it is quite common, not necessarily always in depressed teenagers, but it is certainly significantly apparent in many depressed teenagers.
Is that among boys and girls?
It is. Although in my book, I note that, and perhaps it is a bit of a hot take, when I was in training, we were taught that NSSI, non-suicidal self-injury, is just far more common among girls. And certainly, behaviors like cutting, for example, that is much more common among girls. But I do sometimes wonder if, individuals, males who may kind of manifest their pent-up feelings of, rage or distress, and they punch a wall or, hit something else, if there is almost kind of a similar process going on when those sorts of behaviors occur, when aggression outward actually may be similar in nature to aggression towards oneself. But I think that's something we're still trying to understand more. Unfortunately, there's a lot of stigma surrounding self-injurious behavior, which is incredibly unfortunate. And there's so much shame surrounding these behaviors because I think many people who don't struggle with them often are sort of bewildered by them. And they're wondering, how could someone intentionally try to hurt themselves in this manner? And, sometimes parents will say, well, are they trying to kill themselves? And sometimes it's not suicidal in nature. And it might be to try to cope with really uncomfortable, distressing emotions that one is having. Sometimes it could also be unconsciously to try to avoid a certain situation, like, for example, an argument with parents. And again, it can feel incredibly manipulative, I think, to some parents when a teen is engaging in self-injurious behavior. But it's really important for parents to recognize that teens who are struggling with self-injurious behavior and NSSI, they are trying to figure out how to get their needs met and figure out how to cope with their emotions and their distress. And they are just really not able to do so in a productive, healthy way. And so it's our job as clinicians and parents and other supports to try to help them learn better coping skills and to learn more adaptive ways that they can tolerate their distress and, to identify it and then kind of put those coping skills into action. And so it's so important for us to talk about, to talk about that too when we're talking about depression, because they do oftentimes go hand in hand.
Is there any demographic data on which teens may be at higher risk of depression than others? others?
Yes, absolutely. Although those demographics, I think, have been interestingly, well, at least in terms of things like suicide, are sort of are actively changing, right? For a long time, there was significant evidence that females were more likely to experience depression, and that still holds true. However, people wonder how much of it may also be the fact that males may not be as readily wanting to admit that they have a depressive disorder, right? They might not be identifying as much, with that diagnosis. But conversely, we also know that in certain populations, suicide has been more likely. So white males, at least in the United States, were far more commonly to die by suicide than other demographics. This is still the case, but things are changing, and that Black youth, for example, have rising suicide rates. Indigenous youth have incredibly high suicide rates. And so it's always important, I think, just to be aware that because these shifts are still kind of ongoing, you really have to screen everybody. It's not safe to just consider an adolescent, low risk just because of their demographics, like their gender or their race or ethnicity.
So what should parents do if their teen is having violent thoughts or displaying violent behaviors toward themselves or others?
Well, the first step really is to figure out kind of immediately the imminent safety risk. Whenever you are worried that someone you love might be in danger of harming themselves significantly or harming others, it's critical to figure out how to assess their safety immediately. And I tell parents that this isn't something that you necessarily should take on yourself. In those moments, it's understandable that parents are so scared, either if their child is going to hurt themselves or others, that it can be challenging to think straight. It's the same as any other significant medical condition. If your child had a head injury, parents oftentimes will struggle to think clearly in those moments and navigate the situation. And you would turn to another professional in those situations. And I don't think that self-injurious thoughts or thoughts to harm others should be different. I think when that symptom is apparent, it's absolutely critical that parents try to access emergently someone who can come and talk to their child and assess whether or not the suicidal thoughts are what we would consider representing an imminent threat. So suggestive that the child, if they are not immediately put some place somewhere or protected, that they might act on those thoughts, and significantly harm themselves in some way. But there are also individuals who have suicidal thoughts that maybe sort of what we call more passive in nature, or thoughts that maybe they don't want to be alive anymore, but don't actually want to act on those thoughts to kill themselves. And those are really important and critical distinctions to make, but they're really not easy to make if you're already emotionally overwhelmed and stressed. And many parents oftentimes don't want to think that their child could be having such thoughts. And so it can be very tempting to want to downplay the thoughts that the child is having and say, well, they're just saying that to get attention, or they just say, I want to kill myself because, they're being dramatic, right? And I've heard those phrases from many parents when in fact the teen, is having very significant suicidal thoughts and may even be planning how to harm themselves. So I think first step is certainly always to get an emergent safety assessment.
So when is it time to consider medication?
That's a complicated one. I will give the cop-out answer of I always tell families that the time to consider medication is really when you feel like you're most ready to, with my recommendations that if your symptoms are moderate to severe in nature. So when it's really impacting a teen's life to the point where they're just not functioning well, I oftentimes will say that medications may be something to try, because at those points, right, when the illness is at that stage, the other treatments that we know can help with depression are just so much harder to enact. It's so much harder to get good exercise and good sleep when you are suffering from significant depression. And it's hard to even sometimes go to therapy when you are that depressed. And so when a teen is at that level of severity of symptoms, we'll often say medications really should be tried. But that being said, it really does no one any good for me to force someone to try to take medications who doesn't want to, and especially a depressed teenager. I've certainly had many depressed teenagers who outright, you'll say, like, you should take this medication, and they will just say, okay, and then never take it, or just stop taking it immediately. So it's critical whenever medications are being discussed and proposed that you involve the teenager in that discussion and really try to find a way to come to terms with maybe their reluctance, answering their questions about the medication, certainly, and maybe even creating a plan that they can feel comfortable with if they have specific concerns like side effects, and saying, okay, well, what will happen if I'm experiencing a side effect from it? Can I go off the medication then? Or what do I do? Can I switch medications? Because I think by answering those questions, it makes a teen kind of feel better prepared and removes less of the mystery surrounding taking a medication that, you know, ultimately is going to impact the way that they're feeling. And I think for parents and youth alike, that can feel kind of scary, not knowing what to expect.
Well, let's see if we can wrap this up on a positive note. What are some ways in which parents can influence their teens to adopt a new lifestyle behavior that can lead to better mental health?
That's a great question. I think certain ways to do that are trying to find ways to tie those lifestyle changes to other things that the teenager might be interested in pursuing or maybe more motivated to pursue, for example. So thinking back way in the beginning when we were talking about screens and the way that screens can be helpful. If a teen is incredibly interested in a specific video game or being on screens for a specific purpose, then it can potentially be kind of a carrot such that you can say, okay, well, you can have access to, you know, X that you're interested in, play X game, or this, you can spend X amount of time on social media once you go for a brisk walk, or, you know, once you join us for dinner, or once you participate in some other activity that doesn't involve screens, trying to kind of couple those together in a way that forces the teen to try to engage in some sort of behavior that would be more helpful for their depression recovery.
We're going to have to leave it there. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. But thank you for joining us, Dr. Gansner.
Oh, of course. Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
My guest was Dr. Meredith Gansner. She's the author of the new book, Teen Depression Gone Viral, Why Kids Are More Vulnerable Than Ever, and How You Can Protect Your Child's Health and Happiness. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange on JPR.